Thanks to everyone for joining us today. I'm very pleased that we are now conveying the report of our panel on the athletics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to the public. Our panel was charged with making recommendations on steps that Carolina could take to improve the complex maze of athletics and recommendations that would provide ideas to other universities that are willing to tackle what most agree is a challenging issue for all of higher education. That charge came to us from then-Chancellor Holden Thorpe, and we've had very close cooperation and very good response from Carolina in carrying out our work. In fact, I want to thank the Chancellor's Office, the Athletics Director's Office, for making our work as easy as possible in compiling documents that we requested and providing information. We had a very good panel, five members altogether, and these encompass individuals who have themselves participated in intercollegiate athletics. They also are involved in managing intercollegiate athletics and in working at universities where athletics have been a major concern for a long period of time, so we had very good experience on the panel. We also had help from our former judge from North Carolina, and the panel cooperated quite closely in writing this report. I'm very happy to say that it was an excellent experience from beginning to end. We benefited from many presentations that faculty and staff and students made at the open forum we held in Chapel Hill on April 19th of this year. We read a large number of reports on intercollegiate athletics at Chapel Hill during the course of our work, and we thought that we should come up with a series of serious and substantial recommendations to help the university in its quest for conducting a program that it feels very good about. And that has certainly been a long tradition at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our charge did not call on us to make a detailed assessment of all the policies and procedures that are in place at Chapel Hill, but rather to make recommendations on how Chapel Hill could best think about the place of intercollegiate athletics on the campus going forward, as well as some recommendations that involve national reform. And as you will see from reading the report, we made those as well. I'm happy now to turn it over to Jim Delaney, a member of our panel. Jim?
Thank you, Hunter. I'll make a couple brief comments. As a former student-athlete and a proud graduate of University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, I was honored to serve at the request of Holden Thorpe on the Rawlings panel. Our charge was to suggest practices and approaches that will assist the university and its chancellor and her management team in supporting the right balance between intercollegiate athletics in the context of a great research university. By extension, many of these suggestions are worthy of wider discussion at the national level. A great university does many things well. It does research, it teaches undergraduates, it serves the public. A great athletic program, by definition, must not only align itself with the values of a great university, but it must also meet its regulatory obligations, and it must avoid undue influence by those individuals, whether they're inside or outside the university, that have neither authority or responsibility for key functions in intercollegiate athletics. For example, admission directors admit, athletic directors direct, compliance directors lead, and compliance coaches coach. Doctors and trainers take care of athletes as a primary obligation and responsibility. People in academic support have primary responsibility for student-athlete academic progress along with the student. There must be bright lines to delineate the assignment of responsibility and authority so that, as a result, institutional control can be established and maintained. So our report, in important areas, attempts to not only encourage the establishment of policies and audits in this area, but also to empower those individuals who have the responsibility and the authority to lead in these areas. So, Hunter, with that, I will throw it to Amy Perko.
Thank you, Jim. I'd like to start by commending former Chancellor Holden Thorpe for his leadership in appointing the panel and allowing us to make recommendations that we believe will improve the role of athletics in the life of the university, not only for UNC, but other universities that might find these principles and best practices useful. In my brief remarks today, I'm not speaking for the Knight Commission, for whom I serve as the executive director, but as a member of the panel. Certainly my approach as a panel member has been guided by the principles that the Knight Commission has long promoted for intercollegiate athletics. I want to start first by indicating the approach of the panel was student-focused, and as has been highlighted, with the goal of ensuring that athletics is aligned with the core mission of the university to educate and develop students. The UNC's athletics department's strategic plan certainly highlights this goal. I wanted to touch briefly on two aspects of the panel's recommendations. The first is the financial approach to college sports. This is an area that the panel believes is particularly urgent for UNC and its peer institutions to address, given the escalating costs for athletics at a time when academic budgets have flatlined. The recommendations in this area fall into two categories, with the first including actions that UNC can address on its own. These recommendations call for greater transparency of athletic spending by publishing the institution's NCAA financial reports and other relevant financial data. More broadly, we recommend the institution renew its commitment to maintaining responsible spending for athletics when compared with spending on the academic enterprise. The second area of financial recommendations asks UNC to use its stature to take a leadership position within its conference and nationally to foster necessary discussions about new financial regulatory concepts. These concepts could include whether conferences and or the NCAA should establish spending caps on specific sports for all team operating expenses. This and other concepts offered for consideration aim to develop a financial approach for athletics that will strengthen the educational mission of the university and the student experience. The second aspect of the recommendations I'd like to highlight is the recommendation that UNC and or the ACC consider developing a mandatory education program for coaches. As we all know, coaches are under great pressure to win and are increasingly viewed as being separated from the educational mission of their universities, a perspective that often heightens campus tensions over the role of athletics in the life of the university. We believe coaches will welcome the suggested formal investment into their professional development as educators. Many coaches certainly take advantage of existing opportunities for professional development, but we believe a more formal approach will greatly enhance the tool set coaches carry with them as they work toward positive outcomes of developing young men and women through athletics. With that, I'll turn it back over to Hunter.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Jim. We'll be happy now to take questions from anyone who's on the line.
Thank you. And a reminder to the audience today, if you have a question at this time, to please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. A reminder that if you're joining us via speakerphone today, make sure your mute function is turned off to allow the signal to reach our equipment. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, star 1. And a voice prompt on your phone will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name and your outlet.
You're listening to the Hunter Rawlings panel, or the Rawlings panel on intercollegiate athletics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, live here on WCHL.
Hi, this is Brad Wolverton with the Chronicle of Higher Education. I had a question for Jim and a question for Amy. One was the first one, Jim, on the governance issues, which are really challenging and messy. Where do you see the biggest gaps in governance, and what challenges do you see in some of the panel's ideas being adopted? And then, Amy, can you talk in a little more detail about the ideas behind the spending caps, what sports we would be talking about, and how that would be monitored?
Brad, as Hunter noted, we did not go through in detail the policies and procedures that exist in Chapel Hill with regard to their present governance policies. But the report does speak to the concept, I think, of the chancellor, you know, leading the parade and delegating to the athletic director. And I think it also notes that shared governance is well known to all of us in higher education, where we seek the views of many, ultimately arrive at a consensus, and then try to implement a policy. I think Intercollegiate Athletics has begun to think about its enterprise in a slightly different way, and that is one where the trustees empower the chancellor delegates to key individuals. There is an element, I think, of faculty oversight, but at the same time, because of the passion and interest in intercollegiate athletics, the more bright line that we can have, the more clarity we can have, where you have an alignment of authority and responsibility. It doesn't guarantee that in every case the right decision will be made, but it does allow sort of a retrospective look at a decision-making process to ensure that only those who have been delegated authority and responsibility, and there are a lot of different functions in intercollegiate athletics, but we believe that the key ones are admissions and compliance, academic services, and student-athlete health and welfare. I think you yourself were writing today about the pressures that sometimes are applied to trainers in the area of health and safety. You know, we believe that that function should be separate from certainly the coach's coach, but the doctors and trainers are there primarily to respond to the health and safety needs of the athlete. And so our view going forward is that the more you can nail down, identify these bright lines, the better chance you have to ensure institutional control, and the more you have a chance of avoiding undue influence by those who do not have the delegated authority or responsibility to act in these critical areas.
This is Amy. I'll address, Brad, your question about the concept that was offered around spending caps and the financial approach, and I want to again highlight that the panel's approach was to offer suggestions that we believed could strengthen the educational mission of the university and the student experience in developing a new financial approach for athletics. And again, our approach was to offer a menu of options for consideration, really in an effort to reignite a discussion about some of the possibilities of a different national regulatory approach. And the panel, in its work, studied the data for Division I institutions, studied trends as it related to UNC, and certainly from a looking at it more broadly from a national perspective, the panel certainly believes that the trends are not sustainable and in some cases just not appropriate. That comment is not directed specifically to UNC, but more broadly on the national Division I level. And so the panel offered the concepts, including the concept of asking conferences and or the NCAA to consider establishing spending caps on specific sports for team operating expenses as one of the options that should be considered, and certainly there are others there listed in the report. The panel did not get into the detail of how such concepts, you know, the details that would need to be discussed and certainly studied as to how, you know, those types of each concept could take more shape.
And moving on, we'll go next to Colin Browder with WRAL-TV.
Hi, this is Colin Browder from WRAL-TV here in Raleigh. This could go to any panel member who would like to answer. There have been a number of reports in this realm over the years, perhaps most notably the Knight Commission report, which is even referenced in this one. What real hope, what real expectation do you have that this will not just end up on a shelf somewhere?
This is Hunter Rawlings, and I'll be happy to try to address that. That's a good question. There are lots of reports, as you point out, across the country, and we don't see a lot of reform, and we do refer to that in our report, and we think it's crucial that universities now take this as a very high priority, because, in fact, I think our panel believes we're reaching a tipping point in intercollegiate athletics, and the tipping point comes now because there's so much revenue pouring into intercollegiate athletics, and the budgets for universities' academic programs have been so tight in the past few years that it's out of balance. And I think that's a phrase that our panel talked about quite a lot. The balance between academics and athletics is now perilously close to going over to a tipping point where I think the trend is simply not sustainable, as Amy just said. So you see results from that, such as university presidents losing their jobs over intercollegiate athletic issues. This has been happening at very prominent universities recently, and I think everyone is now cognizant that something needs to be done in order to restore some real balance here. So it's our hope that by making some recommendations in this report for national reform and for the University of North Carolina to take a lead in that, that we might stimulate some serious discussion and action around this point.
Can I add to that the total environment in which all the universities are operating? There have been some positive steps over the past couple of years, and in a couple of areas with regard to strengthening the academic priorities and realigning the financial incentives to reward universities that are prioritizing academic success. An example would be the NCAA adopting the Knight Commission recommendation that teams be on track to graduate at least half their players to be eligible for postseason competition. And that was certainly, you know, that's an example of a positive step that has been taken from a regulatory perspective that does align some of the incentives in the system to those institutions that are putting a priority on academic success.
I would also add to that that, you know, reform is by definition kind of a headliner, and yet adjustments tend to be incremental. Amy just identified one, but I would say in the whole area of academics, the APR, the watching in real time of academic progress, I think has been a positive development. I think another positive development has been the redirection and allocation of some of the revenues towards women's athletics over the last 15 or 20 years. So I think Hunter's point is well taken. The sustainability, especially on the financial side, if there's not some constraint, it stands out in two ways. One, because the academic enterprise isn't growing, and the athletic is. There's no doubt about it that it's expensive to support broad-based programs, but it's also true that the constraints are not built into the system, and we have a very difficult time managing it. Ultimately, some of the spending trends are simply not sustainable given the revenue sources that we have. Everybody reads about large TV contracts, but they don't necessarily understand that the cost of scholarships are rising at twice the rate of inflation, and the cost of supporting broad-based programs are significant. I know that in the Big Ten, our scholarship costs alone have $30 million a year to $150 million a year over the last 25 years. So I think generally there's questions about sustainability, and I think that given the paucity of growth in institutional academic side, the cautions are appropriate.
And Mr. Browder, was there anything further?
No, thank you.
Great, thank you. And I would like to remind the audience at this point, if you do have a question, to please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. And we'll go next to Aaron Beard.
This is Aaron Beard with the AP in Raleigh. This is for Mr. Rawlings. You note in the report that there's sort of the keeping up with the Joneses that schools have to face, the challenges of no one wants to, I guess, put themselves at a competitive disadvantage. You also mentioned maybe, for instance, the ACC conducting some education and that kind of thing. Are you hoping that maybe, is it more on the conferences, I guess, to kind of do something, because it's hard for one school to sort of jump out and sort of do wholesale changes, or, you know, to what they're trying to do with academics and athletics?
We would like, of course, to see conferences take up these questions, and I think sometimes they do, in fact, in trying to address the overall issues that are confronting intercollegiate athletics. But we suggest something else as well, and that is to form a peer group of institutions that look quite similar to one another, because, as you know, in the last few years, the conferences have been growing much larger, and they now include very heterogeneous universities, that is, universities that differ a lot in size and location, and even in some cases in their own missions. So we make the suggestion that Carolina give some real consideration to forming a peer group that would have institutions that are very much alike, research universities, for example, with very high entrance standards like UNC Chapel Hills, because they confront particular challenges in recruiting and admissions processes and in ongoing academic performance that might be different from other competing universities on the field and the playing ground. So we hope that this offers an opportunity to do some new thinking here and to collect some wisdom from those who are facing very, very similar problems.
And we'll take our next question. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Amanda Albright with the Daily Tar Heel. My question was, first, which areas of the report you think will be most challenging to implement? And then I wanted to ask about the mandatory education program for coaches and kind of what role you think coaches should take to student-athletes.
This is Hunter Rawlings. I'll start. I think some of the most challenging ideas in our recommendations are for new initiatives that have been considered over the course of many years but have never been undertaken. For example, the idea that freshmen, particularly those who come to college with some deficits in their academic background, be held out of competition during a special first year when they should concentrate on making academic progress. This has, of course, long been called for but not adopted. And that's a typical problem in that no one wants to do this on his or her own for fear of a competitive disadvantage athletically. So it's that kind of proposal that we think is probably facing the most difficult passage. But I do know that in the past year or so, the NCAA has actually taken this up as a recommendation and had some discussion of it. And we're hoping that something might be done in this area to, again, put the emphasis on academics in a domain where academics are often taking a back seat to athletics. So that's the kind of thing we think will be most difficult, and we ask Carolina to give some consideration to these ideas and to working with other universities to see if they can't be implemented. On the coaches program, I'll ask Amy if she'd like to respond to that.
Sure, I'd be glad to. As the report indicates, the panel placed a great emphasis on the role of the coach with regard to the life of and the experience of the athlete. Surveys of athletes have indicated that the coach is one of the most, if not the most, important mentor a student athlete has at the university. So certainly the role the coach plays in the experience of the student cannot be overstated. So the panel wanted to make this recommendation with the goal of improving the relationship between college sports and the educational missions of the universities to really emphasize the coach's role as a key educator. And certainly, again, the acknowledgement that many coaches take advantage of optional professional development opportunities that are available, but the panel believed that it's time for a more formal system and approach to recognizing the coach's role as an educator in college sports.
And we'll move on to the next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Greg Childress, Herald Sun. And this question is for Amy. When you talk about the spending caps on specific sports, are we to assume that you're talking about football and basketball? And if so, why?
Well, just talking generally about spending caps and not a specific sport, but again, that concept is offered as one that the panel believes that conferences and the NCAA should study, because again, it goes back to looking at the financial data and the trends that have shown that athletic spending has been escalating at a rate twice as fast as academic spending across Division I. Certainly UNC Chapel Hill is a member of a conference that, along with four other conferences, will see tremendous increases in their revenues due to new media contracts. In terms of what the projections hold in that regard, they're not going to change, and the projections would show the gaps would be even greater. So certainly what has been identified as the trends are, as what's been noted, that these trends just are not sustainable and in some cases not appropriate for the goal of ensuring that athletics is strengthening the educational mission of the university. So going back to the concepts that are offered, there's not a silver bullet, of course, to solve all these problems, but certainly the panel believed that serious discussion needed and study was needed to consider such concepts as spending caps in order to help the universities better manage the financial approach as it relates to, number one, making sure that college sports is healthy across the board, not just college football, not just college basketball, but the broad mission of college sports is to provide opportunity and not just for one or two sports. And then also to make sure that financial approach does strengthen the overall educational mission of the university and the student experience.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question. Please go ahead.
My question was asked. Thank you.
Thank you. And to the audience, a reminder, if you do have a question at this time, to please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Additionally, if your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2.
Your line is open.
Please go ahead.
This is Rand Northam with 97.9 FM WCHL. Two questions. Are you concerned that coaches will push back about a mandatory education? I know that you said that there has always been interest with coaches wanting to get involved with some non-mandatory parts of education, but are you concerned at all that they'll say, well, if this is mandatory, I don't have time for that specifically? And then secondly, with the qualitative assessment of at-risk prospective athletes, how does the admissions office or whoever is reviewing that, how do they determine that? Should there be a national definition or a school-wide definition of that? I imagine a school-wide one, sure.
I'll jump. Dr. Rawlings, you want me to address the coaches, and then I'll turn the other over to you?
Yeah, Amy, that would be great. And maybe Jim would want to talk about the qualitative assessment of athletes. And if not, I'll be happy to.
Okay. With regard to the coaches' education, I really believe that the coaches will welcome a more formal investment into their professional development as educators. I've had coaches say to me that with the increased pressures on coaches, that they wished schools would invest more money on the front end to helping them be successful, rather than putting money into incentives for winning, because coaches are ultimately involved in college sports because of their desire to help athletes develop as people, not only develop in their specific sport. So again, it's going back to why college sports exist, and it exists as part of the education and development of young men and women through athletics. And I really believe that coaches will welcome that type of formal investment.
Hunter, I'll take a shot at the at-risk issue. Having played at a different time and place when freshmen weren't eligible, I think that year of transition was really helpful. In 1972, freshmen became eligible, and immediately they had the academic and athletic challenge. You know, we all want the athlete to be successful athletically and have a reasonable chance to get a degree. I think it's very clear that freshman ineligibility in a blanket sense will never happen. I don't quibble with that reality. But I do think that both at the institutional level and at the NCAA level, we should focus on what I would describe as targeting, for the best academic interest of the student, those kids who don't project to have a reasonable chance of graduating. It could be done at the national level. We've attempted to deal with it with a partial qualifier. I think that the NCAA board has discussed it a lot in the last couple years, but I would say this: if a person does not predict the likelihood of graduating at better than 50%, I think that person by definition is at risk. It's not to say that some of them won't graduate, but many of them will not. And so it's for that category of student, those who you predict either at the institutional level based on your quantitative assessment or at the national level quantitatively that are less likely than likely to graduate, I think that we ought to sit down with our coaches, to be honest with you, and try to identify ways to not only provide them more academic support and more time, but also for the admissions people, to, especially at highly selective institutions, to really honestly address, can this person graduate with both academic and athletic expectations?
And if the answer is no, then, you know, certainly that's the answer. If it's with a lot of additional help, we provide the help. If it's let's give them some relief from the normal exposure to athletics, which really is not 20 hours a week. All the research tells you it's closer to 40 hours a week. And perhaps there's an in-between institutional answer which says we'll admit, we'll provide support, but we're also going to make sure that the person, individual, has more chance to prepare academically and transition. So I think the answer could be national. I doubt if it would be conference-wide, but it could be local as well, because Carolina is a very selective institution. It's rigorous expectations academically. And I don't think that because a person is NCAA eligible, that automatically makes them a likely candidate for getting a degree, especially with the athletic emphasis. So long answer to a very good question, but it's something short of freshman ineligibility. It's targeting individuals who you think have a very uphill chance of graduation, and it should be tailored individually as best that can be done.
Thank you.
And we'll move on to the next question. Caller,
your line is now muted.
It's Jane Stansel at the News and Observer. I have a question about what you think the NCAA's role should be in all this. And also, back to what Mr. Delaney was saying about hours involved for student-athletes and your idea of reducing those hours. Is that realistic with the geographic growth of conferences?
Well, let me just take a shot, because I've spoken to this issue outside of the panel. So the panel was asked to provide some assessment to our new chancellor, and also we understood that that those recommendations might be picked up by others. But I don't think necessarily that the size of conferences has a lot of relevancy to these recommendations, except to the extent that Hunter noted that as conferences become larger, they're more heterogeneous. The more heterogeneous they are, the more difficult it becomes to set standards that affect everyone comparably. But I do believe that the restructuring of the NCAA is an opportunity to reassess what the right balance is going forward in the 21st century. And to me, it means that we take account of the time spent on athletics. I think that's going to require a revisitation. I think it requires that we use some of the resources that we have to meet the miscellaneous expenses that are not now covered under our scholarships up to the cost of education. I think it also requires that we help at-risk students with additional help if that's what they need, and we work with our coaches to find a way to do that. And at the end of the day, if we take the risk on the student and provide the support that we should, I think there ought to be a lifetime educational trust or commitment between the institution and the athlete. And if we restructure and we don't have a 21st century idea of what a fair plan is, then I think we've missed the mark. I think the NCAA is an organization that needs to reinvent itself. And I think it needs to reinvent itself for institutions like UNC and others so that these vexing challenges can be better met.
I'll just add on the issue of reducing hours. There, we're simply making a common sense recommendation. The idea that a student athlete should devote 40-some hours to practice and games in their sport and at the same time try to be good students poses obvious difficulties, particularly for those students who don't have the educational background that you might hope for at an institution like Chapel Hill. So we're trying there simply to make common sense recommendation to say this is, again, out of balance. and Carolina and other institutions should take a good, strong look at trying to restore some balance there and making it clear that the academic priority that comes first.
And a reminder to the audience, if you do have a question at this time, to please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. And we'll take our next question. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Harold Gutman with the Durham Herald Sun. This question is for Mr. Rowling. You wrote about the 1989 faculty report that called for radical changes, such as making freshmen ineligible, eliminating spring football practice. Obviously, these changes never occurred. I'm wondering, did you purposefully tone down your recommendations to make them more feasible this time?
We noted that report because it did make a lot of recommendations that have not made much headway over the years, and we wanted to make it clear that we hoped our report would not suffer a similar fate. So we're calling for some common-sense recommendations, as we said, others that are more forward-looking and are going to require greater effort. And it's our strong hope and expectation that these recommendations will be taken seriously and conversation will get started on trying to effect action. It's pretty clear to us, as we say in the beginning of our report, that the national scene now is one of great change and call for further change. So whether it's the potential class action lawsuit that is now on the front burner, or the major changes and call for alterations in NCAA structure, all of these things are posing great challenges to intercollegiate athletics and to university administrators. And we think that in that context, it's more likely that change will occur.
Thank you.
And Mr. Gutman, was there anything further, sir? And we'll move on to the next question. Please go ahead.
This is Courtney Mitchell from the University Gazette. You'd mentioned that UNC could be a leader on this issue. What makes UNC so well positioned to be that leader?
We think UNC is in a great position for a couple of major reasons. It's a leading research university in the United States, well known for the high quality of its faculty, first-rate research program that has, in fact, grown very strongly in the last few years, and a very high-quality student body and academic program. So on the one hand, Carolina is well known as a leading public research university. Secondly, over the course of many decades, Carolina has been running a superb athletics program that has kept itself, I think, very much out of the kinds of problems that other athletic programs have run into until quite recently. And so traditionally, Carolina has been known as one of those universities that knows how to conduct its athletic program within the proper boundaries. It's only in the last couple of years that serious problems have emerged. But given that strong academic reputation and the long tradition of a very good athletics program, we think Carolina is in a very unusually good position to take the lead in the kinds of reforms that we're calling for.